Oh, you could have let it. You could have let it. Let me laugh over it if you wanted to. Harry ain't really here today. It's Friday. We've been together all week. Okay.
The wheels keep turning.
All right. Well, it's 10 o'clock. And you know, if it's 10 o'clock, it's time for Love Babs Love Talk on 103.5 FM WNHH. Live streaming on NewHavenIndependent.org. And live streaming on Facebook, too. New Haven Independent Facebook. So my dear friend, Jeff Grant, is in the house today.
Hey, Babs.
What's happening? You have to get closer to the mic.
I got to get closer. There I am. Hey,
there
Babs.
There you go. What's happening?
Hey, it's good to see you.
It's nice to see you.
Yeah.
So I was talking about you all week because I know you're coming in here to catch me up on matters of reentry.
Yeah, there's a lot of them in the state.
I know.
Yeah.
So are you going over to the Yale Mass Incarceration Conference?
I don't think so today. I'm a little sick, you know, so I think I'm going to hit the office for a little while and go back to bed.
So what's new? What's going on? Hey, Andrew, I know if you're listening, I'm not going to shout you out too much, Andrew, but I know, you know, you're part of this band. So, hey.
So, you know, things are kind of popping around the state.
What's happening?
A bunch of us from Family Reentry. Oh, since I was last here,
yeah,
I got appointed as executive director of Family Reentry, the nonprofit serving criminal justice community.
Yeah,
so that's big news.
Yes, it's big news.
And I know we've had lunch since then, but haven't been on the air since then. And so that's you know, that's pretty much a full time gig. You know, we're based in Bridgeport, but we have offices in New Haven. And
I know
Norwalk.
You're next door to me in New Haven.
That's right, exactly. In up in the
Fitch Street,
in the parole building.
Yes, I know. It feels like it, right?
It is a parole building.
Yeah. So,
and you know, things are happening really well there in terms of our outreach, our advocacy. We were up in the state capitol 2 days ago testifying before the appropriations committee for this new budget.
Okay.
That, you know.
What are you worried? I mean, because you guys already took a hit.
We took a big hit last year, but it looks like we're going to do okay this year. You
really?
Know? Yeah, I think so. And, but the senators there and the appropriation committee were grateful we were there. We actually were the only contingent from Bridgeport to go up and spend the evening there. So I think we made a statement about our intentions and our willingness to collaborate and the respect that we show the state legislature, because, you know, these are all good intended people and they're trying to do the best they can, but it's a pretty nasty fiscal situation that's going on in the state right now.
Yeah. I mean, but it's going to get worse, I think, before it gets better.
Yeah, I think that this budget cycle is going to be tough. But at Family Reentry, you know, we've balanced the budget. We've made the cuts we need to make. All of our programs now are intact. We have we're the strongest we've been in years, probably. And we're looking at a lot of private money so we can do public-private partnerships, which we think is the wave of the future.
Yeah. I would say so, yes.
You know, and I think that if we show the good faith to the state that we're willing to step up and be advocates for social change and get program dollars in from the private sector, that maybe in the next budget cycle, so 2 years from now, they'll be willing to at least meet us halfway. And and we feel good about that, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, you know.
So you're happy over there. I mean, you feel purposeful and, you know.
Well, Babs, when I was sitting in prison 10 years ago, I would say the last thing that I would have guessed was that, first of all, I would go to a seminary and become a minister, right? Then spend 2 years in the inner city in Bridgeport at the First Baptist Church, and then be appointed the first person in the country who served time for a white-collar crime to be appointed as executive director of a major criminal justice agency. So I feel blessed about that.
Well, I mean, you have a skill set, right? Like, you're not just some, you know, whatever. I mean, you've got real skill set and reasoning ability and talent. So that's not a hard choice, right?
Well, I think that anyone who comes out of prison finds it hard to get a job, get
a career back going.
I know this radio gig probably doesn't pay much. But I'm not different than anyone else. You know, I had to spend 10 years rebuilding my credibility and my bio and doing a lot of volunteering, you know. Having faith, you know, one step at a time and just not trying to control the outcome so much, just do the next right thing. Mm-hmm. And things came to me. I'm like, for example, when I applied to seminary, I was 2 years out of prison at the time, and I had been volunteering in Stamford and then in Bridgeport for family reentry. And my calling came to me to, and kind of in a faith journey, really, to apply to seminary. And I didn't really know what I was going to do or what I was going to do with it. I had this kind of small little piece of an idea there that maybe there could be a ministry for white collar criminals and their families, but it wasn't really fully developed. Mm-hmm. And I applied to Union Theological Seminary in New York, which is probably the preeminent urban seminary in the country, maybe the world. Very, very liberal, very progressive. And when I filled out that application, it was the first time that I had told my complete story anywhere, and I had to do it in writing because I had to be honest with them. And I was completely honest, and they accepted me. So it was really like post-prison, the first time I felt a sense of acceptance and warmth. Mm-hmm. And I went there for 3 years.
That's a good while. That's a good amount of time.
Yeah, it was full-time for 3 years.
Wow.
So, you know, I worked all during.
But, I mean, I knew this part of your story, but I didn't know it was for that long.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's up in Morningside Heights, which 120th and Broadway. Mm-hmm. And so I would take the train. Now, we were living in Greenwich at the time in a little apartment by the train station. And I would take the train down 125th Street and then hustle across town. It depends on the weather, you know. On a nice day, I would walk it. On a nasty day, I would wait for the M120.
Okay.
You know, which coming
that's
from
the bus, right?
The bus coming come across town from LaGuardia Airport.
Yes.
And it was a great experience, you know, and I learned a lot about advocacy and activism and a kind of a different look at what ministry is really about. You know, I grew up, as you know, I grew up Jewish, and I became baptized in around 2010. I'm not sure exactly if it was 2010 or 2011, but certainly during my seminary journey. And I consider myself a double belonger. I didn't make that term up. I think my professor, Paul Nitter might have made up that term. I'm not sure.
So you're just covering all your bases.
Yeah, well, listen. Actually, it depends which room I'm in.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like not everybody digs that.
But do you feel Jewish?
Sure, of course I feel Jewish. Okay. I mean, the basis of my personal theology is probably embedded in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And I grew up, you know, I grew up Jewish. I grew up on Long Island as a Jewish kid on Long Island and did everything that kids on Long Island do, you know, drinking and drugging and trying to avoid going to synagogue, which is true. And, you know, when I was young, my parents would drop us off for Hebrew school. We would wait for the car to leave, and then we would walk up the block to the bowling alley.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, go bowling and then come back in time for when the Hebrew school let out. Yeah, so, picking up that 10-pin. But it really was a different experience in seminary than I expected. And I know you and I have talked a lot about our faith journeys and, your church here on Whaley Avenue, right?
Or, Whitney and Cold Spring.
Oh, yeah, Whitney and Cold
Church
Spring.
Of the Redeemer.
Exactly. I love that church.
I do too.
Yeah. Is Marilyn there anymore?
No, you know what? She got a calling to another church to be a pastor. I think it's in Ansonia.
Yeah, it's up there somewhere, up Route 8 somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhere, yes. I can't call the name of it. But she's doing well. I saw her, she came to Redeemer, she came to visit for something. I can't remember what it was. I think it was maybe a prayer service for, like, I don't know, whatever. You know, so many prayer services right now because of everything that's going on in the world.
Well, she's a beautiful person.
She is.
And it's actually the type of person that in some ways I don't understand. because she's given herself over to ministry for criminal justice.
Yeah.
And she's never been to prison. And as far as I know, she doesn't have a direct family member in prison. So, I mean, what a wonderful heart and an open spirit she has.
Mm-hmm.
And if I hadn't been to prison and it wasn't part of my story, I don't know that I would be doing prison ministry. You know, I don't know. I'd probably be in real estate still.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, so.
Do you think you might want to go back to real estate ever? Ever?
Never.
No?
No. Well, you know, that rah-rah go-go life as a lawyer and real estate and all those other things I was doing almost killed me.
Mm-hmm.
So unless I have a death wish, I don't think I want to go back to. I was making a lot of money, but it was really corrupting my spirit.
Yeah.
And I don't accuse anybody of anything. You know, for some people, I'm sure they're making a lot of money and they're living a good life or a righteous life. I can't look inside anyone else's house, but in my house, you know, I wasn't well balanced, and it hurt me. So obviously, in my story, you know, I wound up, you know, going to prison for a white collar crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably occasioned by the desperation and the need to pay the mortgage and pay all those people who were working for me, and the 10 years of prescription painkillers that I was on that completely eroded my judgment. And, you know, I think back, it's almost like a dream.
Yeah.
You know?
I certainly understand that. I certainly understand that.
So, you know, so right now, as you know, what we have is we have two projects going on. Family Reentry, which is my day job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly an inner city project. I would say that most people are from the kind of impoverished or racial injustice kind of areas where they really didn't have an opportunity to have a start in life. You know, they a lot of them grow up with one parent families and poor education systems and not access to health care and all kinds of problems that you have in the inner city. And so they wind up on the track to go to prison, but it's our, it's my personal mission and certainly the mission of Family Reentry to give them, to work on the community and the family issues so that they don't have the problem to begin with,
mm-hmm.
you know, give them a first chance. I mean, we're here, you know, we're here sitting here talking about a second chance and in this state and what do we do for people when they come back from prison? But wouldn't it be great if we actually focus some attention on what and strengthening these communities and families so maybe they don't have to go to prison to begin with?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know if we're ever going to be having that conversation. But if you just tuned in, this is Babs Rawls Ivy, and I'm talking to my friend Jeff Grant, the executive director of Family Reentry. You're listening in on 103.5 FM, WNHH, live streaming on newhavenindependent.org, and live streaming on Facebook. So if you're watching us, there's Jeff, here's me.
it's the time lag getting me.
I know, it's funny.
Yeah.
So Jeff, do you have any concerns about this political climate?
Yeah, of course I do.
Like, is anybody, like, I mean, I don't think anybody's talking directly about, well, let me say this. I hear rumors that whatever Obama did to sort of start the beginning of shutting down for-profit prisons, the opposite is happening now. They're starting to amp those back up.
I read that in the paper just this morning, I think. In a way, I feel like it's kind of a misdirection play because, again, you and I both know that all prisons are really for-profit prisons. I mean, they're there to, you know, the prison industrial complex, even for public prisons, is there to basically make money on the backs of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander put it. And we know it's true. So I think that enlightened criminal justice reform means that what we're going to do is we're going to lower prison populations, and what we should be doing is justice reinvestment so that, say, for every $100 million you save in a state from reducing the prison population, closing prisons, some percentage of that should go into community-based solutions so that these people who are coming out of prison are going to have the best chance they can get
mm-hmm.
of being successful post prison. But in the current environment, the state wants to save the money, so they're reducing the prison population, which is a good thing, but they're not putting a lot of money back into the communities, which is a very bad thing. And I think that we have a right to be concerned, because the worst thing possible can be is that we've let people out of prison and they don't have access to substance abuse counseling, mental health counseling, or other wraparound services. And so a job, a house, housing.
Yeah.
And then what choice do they have but go back to the old behavior that sent them to prison in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be very difficult for anyone to rationalize after the fact if somebody got really hurt. There was like another home invasion, or there was a mass killing of some sort, and from someone who wouldn't otherwise be in prison, and it sets the state back another decade in terms of prison reform.
Yeah.
But I don't know how that's necessarily avoidable if we don't have these services for people who come out to help them succeed.
So do you, I want to believe that we made some inroads and some strides, but you know, the more I look at this thing, the more I'm like, you know, I think our attention is often in the wrong places. Although, you know, New Haven is about to pilot this program that will do a couple of things. Go into the prisons when people are like a year to 6 months about to come out and do some kind of counseling, get them prepared to come out. And then a connection with the housing authority to provide housing for a percentage of that population as a pilot, to see how that can be helpful and beneficial. And I think those are the kinds of partnerships that you were talking about, I think.
Yeah, that's really the public. Yeah, yes, that's true. I think Mayor Harp here has done a fantastic job in terms of being at the forefront of prison reform
mm-hmm.
and criminal justice collaboration. The Warren Kimbrough Project, for example, that's chaired, I think, by Earl Bloodworth here in New Haven. They have a project to go into the prisons, and basically what Warren Kimbrough does, it takes the most difficult, most at-risk prisoners and goes into the prison 3 or 6 months in advance. I'm not sure exactly how much.
Yep.
And it gives them the best chance of success when they come out. And it also convenes a lot of the stakeholders in New Haven who have various prison projects, whether it be Easter Seals Goodwill or Family Reentry mm-hmm. or some of the other partners, and gives them a voice and tries to create efficiencies and optimize the results we can get. Because, you know, there's a lot of overlap in different nonprofits. The other project they have is called Fresh Start. And that was the one that really started it. Now, both of these projects are out of the mayor's office.
Yes. But Clifton Graves heads up Fresh Start.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And they handle, like, the other, the numbers might be off a little bit, but they handle maybe the 30% of people who are the least at risk in terms of their release and the least public safety risk. And so between those two projects, they're capturing a lot of the inmates who will become formerly incarcerated persons out on the street,
mm-hmm.
and they're providing a lot of services. So, hats off to New Haven for doing that. There's other projects in other cities that are doing it. Hartford is lifting one off, and so is Bridgeport. I would say that New Haven's been the leader at this, but in Bridgeport, we have something out of the mayor's office called MIRA, which is the Mayor's Initiative for Reentry Affairs, and that's chaired, the liaison there, the program manager is Lewis Reed,
mm-hmm.
and he's an up-and-comer. This guy's just fantastic, and I've been appointed co-chair of the advisory council to MIRA.
So how's that looking? Like, how... I mean, because, you know, you have a mayor that's formerly incarcerated, and does he care about reentry?
Oh yeah. I think that Mayor Ganim is really right on top of this now. I mean, it's a It's a big topic for Bridgeport. You know, a lot of returning citizens come home to Bridgeport.
Uh-huh.
And in the thousands. And what to do with them and in terms of providing services and trying to help their the success of their reentry is right up there. So to do it on a city-by-city basis is great. Probably not optimal in, mm-hmm. in the sense that if the state money's not there, there's a limit to what the city can actually afford to do. The cities are in the same have the same problems that the state does in terms of their financial problem.
Yeah. So you said the legislators seem to be favorable to understanding the need for funding reentry programming.
Now, if you stuck in a room, the head of CSSD, which judicial branch, you know, court support services, the head of the Department of Corrections, Scott Semple,
mm-hmm.
the legislators, the mayors of the cities, and all the nonprofits, everybody would agree as to what's the right thing to do and basically how to do it, but for the fact that there's no money to do it. So we have like wonderful people out there who really want to invest in criminal justice mm-hmm. reform everyone understands the problem, just how to do the workaround because of the lack of funds is a little bit different depending on who you talk to, because everybody has their own political pressures and they have to answer to different budget constraints and work, do the most they can with a lot less money. So, you know, we certainly understand it. And we think that all in all, they're great partners. But it's a shame the state. The state had a real leadership role in criminal justice reform not that long ago. And we were a model state, justice reinvestment model, and in terms of pro-social reforms. The whole country was looking at Connecticut as a leader. That's probably not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Connecticut. Here's really the problem with Connecticut. Do we have time to talk about this?
Yes, we have time.
Right. So here's the problem with Connecticut, as far as I can tell. Unlike our neighbors to the north and the south, Massachusetts has Boston, which is wealthy, and New York has New York City, which is wealthy. But Connecticut doesn't have any wealthy cities. The cities in Connecticut are basically where the poverty is. Even if the core of the city has some business in it, the people who live in most of the people who live in these cities are impoverished. So the wealth in Connecticut is really in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you convince someone who's living in Greenwich or New Canaan or Darien or Westport that criminal justice is something that they should be cognizant of, and it's really a complete statewide issue, and that if they don't if they don't influence their legislators and they're not willing to fund it, then what they're really doing is hurting everybody, including themselves, because of safety issues and because of the tax base, and also just humanitarian reasons. I mean, mm-hmm. nobody should have to go to prison because that their personal family circumstances when they were young didn't afford them the other opportunities in life, so they turned to the streets and they turned to the hustle. You know, that's a hard thing. So you know, our other project that you know about is the Progressive Prison Project, or Progressive Prison Ministries, and that's a ministry for white collar criminals and their attorney and mm-hmm. their families. So you know, that's a pretty misunderstood group of people. I'm one of them. It's a nice conversation between two white collar criminals. But the in places like Greenwich or New Canaan or affluent suburbs, pretty much until recently, they didn't really recognize crime in their midst. You know, if you went into a church in Greenwich, for example, you'd see people who were dressed up nicey-nice
mm-hmm.
to go to church on Sundays, but there's people in their community who are suffering because of criminal justice issues, whether it be white-collar crime issues or DUI issues, or they're suffering because of substance abuse or mental health issues. And fundamentally, the church is set up to be able to help the oppressed. I mean, you know, there's Matthew 25. That's what it's about. The least of these. But in many of these churches, the most spiritual place in the church is in the AA room downstairs in the basement. But I think that's changing. I think that even in the affluent communities, they're starting to understand that the constituency in those communities is really different than they would imagine, or the purpose of the church is really more inclusive, and it's not good enough in a church, say in Greenwich, to do a midnight run or to write checks for the inner city like in Bridgeport, and that's a good thing. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. And in Bridgeport, because I worked in a church in Bridgeport, you don't do outreach, you don't do midnight runs. You're the church where the midnight runs come to. So it's more like in-reach, really, and you know that. But I think that we're starting to make inroads, and we have some partner churches in and around the area. For example, Christ Church in Greenwich has accepted us as an outreach ministry. Norfield Congregational Church in Weston, there's two perfect examples of churches that are very socially minded and caring communities, and are starting to open up their doors to be inclusive to everyone. In the last few weeks, I give workshops at Wilton Presbyterian, at the Golden Hill Methodist in Bridgeport.
And what do these workshops look like?
It's basically bringing awareness of what the problems are in every community, and kind of on an egalitarian basis. What it is to have an accepting and open environment in your church, in your local church, and be aware, kind of have an authentic ministry to what's really going on in your church, and what does that look like? So, I mean, many of these churches have so-called prison ministries, and I think that's a beautiful thing. Primarily what they are really is chaplaincies. So, you know, four or five or six people from the church once a month will go into a correctional facility and do some kind of program with the inmates for, you know, 20 or 30 inmates. And I think that's a beautiful thing. But if they're not ministering to the people who are right in their community who are suffering, then they're really missing an important opportunity and a beautiful opportunity, because they can open their doors and they can be welcoming. And so you can imagine a woman and her children who are sitting in a house in Greenwich, and the father has been convicted of a white collar crime, and he goes off to prison, and they're sitting there in this house and they have no money. They're on food stamps. They can't afford to heat the house. They're about to lose the house, so they're just trying to do the best they can with what they have. They've been shunned in the community. They've been kicked out of their clubs. They've been maybe kicked out of their houses of worship even. If their kids were, say, in private school, the kids can't go to that school anymore. There's no money. And if the kids were in, say, a parochial school, like a Catholic school or something like that, maybe they'll get scholarshiped in, maybe not. So the first victims of all of this are really the family.
I don't think people think about that. I don't think people think about beyond the person that committed the crime. I don't think they do. I think they just think, you know, well, you committed this crime, you get what you deserve. But you never think about all the tentacles that sort of stem from that.
Yeah.
I mean, family, community, church, whatever, job.
Yeah. I mean, even the concept of quote unquote committing a crime, you know, there's a certain amount of randomness to that as to who's going to be prosecuted and who's not going to be prosecuted and what the sentence is going to be, and conversation around mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines and prosecutorial misconduct, wrongful conviction. All these things are in there, and it's unsettled right now. For example, it's even unsettled what the definition is of insider trading. There's a perfect example of something that I would think that at least the hedge fund community in around Fairfield County is keenly aware of, but nobody knows really what it is. And it's a line that keeps moving, And in some cases, you don't know you've crossed it until there's two FBI agents standing on your doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be the same exact thing you were doing 5 years ago. But 5 years ago, it wasn't a crime, and now it's a crime now, although the legislature never decided that. Somehow it was decided in the court system or something like that. And or it's the same thing that is going on in at one trading desk, for example, as two trading desks next to each other could be doing the same exact behavior, but only one of them gets prosecuted and the other one doesn't. So it's very unsettled. And it has a huge effect on the families and the communities. We're trying to bring awareness to that in our progressive prison ministries, and be you know, be inclusive. Let people know that they're not lepers, and we can, and we're all God's children, and we can have empathy and compassion for everybody. And it's not just, you know, we cut people off and have them floating off on an ice raft because. There, but for the grace of God, go I. Anybody, it could happen to anybody in some way or another. So,
I don't think people believe that, though. I don't think most people believe that they don't believe that anything could happen to them. I think people believe you make a choice to sort of do whatever, and that's because you're whatever. You're weak, or you're small, or you're greedy, or you're unstable, or you know, you're just all these things. And so I don't think people believe that they could find themselves in a bind. But clearly you can't. I mean, I had Norm Pattis on yesterday, and he was talking about, you know, he just defended this case with the guy who's sentenced for murdering his baby, tossing it off the bridge.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sat here and said, he's like, I took that case because, you know, I saw myself in that guy. And I thought, I was like, you, you know. I was just stunned. But what the point he was making was that anybody could just find themselves in situations. You just find yourself in a situation, you know.
You know, in terms of public awareness and the way that people feel about these problems, I think there's just basically two classes of people. And not that there's a class system, but I think there's the man or woman on the street. There's a person who really doesn't, you know, just basically goes about their day, and they have kids in school, or they go grocery shopping, or they go to their jobs, and that's that type of person, and they're going to have some kind of view towards crime or white collar crime or inner city crime. They're going to have a view about it, and it's going to be generally a step away from the people who are actually at risk. You know, they're living their normal lives, and they're probably never going to have a crime touch them, or if it does, it's not particularly in their house. But the people who are the decision makers, the people who are captains of industry, the people who, even on the street, the guys who are, you know, who have the drug gangs or whatever, who, you know, if they're people who are actually involved in that kind of commerce, they know the truth. They know that everyone's potentially one day away from having a policeman knock on your door for something that either you're doing wrong, or that someone else thinks you're doing wrong, or that maybe there's a little bit of confusion in the law.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard thing sometimes to mediate as to quote unquote what the right thing is when you're being asked to perform for a boss, for example, who's very, very demanding. And wants you to deliver, you know, on profitability, or wants you to deliver on net money to the firm, or even in the inner city. You know, if you're there in the street hustle, you've got a job to do, and that's your culture. That's what you were raised on.
Mm-hmm.
And without it, they might go hungry. So, you know, I have a lot of openness and compassion for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that almost anybody, once they've been to prison, as you know, when they come out, most people I encounter, especially at family reentry in Bridgeport, which is where I spend most of my time, they don't want to go back to being criminals. The last thing in the world they want to do. It was terrible. I mean, people did a 10-year prison bid. The last thing they want to do is go back to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone goes through some kind of transformative experience, as you know. But whether or not that they can stay in that long enough to be able to live a life of providing for their families and providing for themselves without going back to criminal behavior has to do with the amount of opportunities that we will actually provide mm-hmm. for them because of the limitation of their felonies or their criminal records that allows them to, that prohibits them from being able to work in many, many areas.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Well, I would suspect that Mayor Ganim has really elevated folks coming out of prison. I mean, that is true reentry at its finest. To come back and get your life back in such a way, right? Like, that's true reentry, I guess.
You know, the fact that it's kind of right here, like right in Bridgeport,
yeah,
and it's tangible. It's something we can feel. I mean, like Marion Barry did it in Washington D.C.
Yeah,
and there's other places.
Yeah, other places.
And that guy in Toronto who was, you know, up there doing all kinds of crazy stuff. But here we are, like right in Bridgeport, and I think it presents itself with a lot of hope. With, you know, despite what anybody thinks Mayor Ganim did or didn't do, and all that always winds up getting distorted in the press, so nobody really knows the story. But and I don't either. But I can tell you that for anyone who's come back as strong as he has and have been reelected by the largest city in Connecticut, says something not just about him, which is something positive and hopeful, but also says something about the electorate, that they're willing to trust someone again who they may have breached their trust in the past. So, mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful thing.
I think so. I mean, it really is a true story of redemption. You know, I know people feel some kind of way about it, but I mean, I don't really care about that. But on the other end, you have John Rowland, right? Governor John Rowland, who did time, came out, got his life together, was doing whatever, and then got sucked back into something. And now, is he serving now?
I believe he's in prison now.
But how much time does he have to do? Not like a couple of years, right?
I think at least a couple of years, maybe more, 3 or 4 years.
I think three to somewhere between 3 and 5.
But he's really an outlier to all of this because the overwhelming majority of people who are convicted for white collar crimes
are not going to do it again.
And now you could argue that part of the reason they're not going to do it again is because they don't have access to the same careers any longer.
Yeah.
But
there is that.
So, you know, it makes you really think about what kind of like a criminal disposition really is. I mean, are you really predisposed to crime, or is it really situational based upon the things that are in front of you and whether or not you got sucked into an ecosystem that really is not healthy? And I can tell you that there's a there's a lot of examples where guys, it's primarily a male dominated area, the white collar crime, and I can tell you there's a lot of examples where a guy knows he's in the midst of crossing the line, and he doesn't want to do it, and he's conflicted about doing it. But what happens is that he doesn't have the ego strength to walk into his bedroom and say to his wife, "Listen, I'm not the man I thought I was, or I'm not capable of earning money the way I thought I would, or things are not really as sturdy as I've represented to you. And so what we need to do here is we need to downsize our life. We need to get more simple. We need to sell this big house, whatever it is. We need to take steps so that I'm not perpetuating this problem." Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the reasons that they don't do it by and large is because they're insecure and they're afraid that their wives are really only staying with them for their money. And they don't want that conflict to be there because they're afraid that the wife will acknowledge exactly what they're afraid of, and then they'll be alone in the world. So what happens is that in their effort to please, you know, people please, or please their wives, or please their families, or please their employers, they wind up pleasing nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly suffered from that, so I understand it. Just a couple things I want to point out. I want to make sure that everyone knows. First, for people who are have been convicted of white-collar crimes and have come back from prison or through their problems in chief, we have an online support group now.
Which I haven't been able to tackle.
Yeah, it would be nice if you log on. But it's Tuesday nights, 8 o'clock Eastern, and we have people all over the country. We do it on GoToMeeting, so it's a video conference. And people who have been living in isolation, and we formed a community of formerly incarcerated white-collar criminals who are finding a lot of comfort and solutions in one another,
mm-hmm.
because primarily it's a non-geographic problem. It's not like, say, walking into an AA room where everyone has the same problem, but everybody lives in the same town, so they can come together, you know, as physically in that town. But white-collar crime is kind of spread out all over the country, and we've helped people in 25 different states at this point.
So
gathering them, due to technology, we can actually gather, you know, a cohort and be able to help. The other thing I want to mention at Family Reentry, which is, you know, where I spend most of my time now, we have a big event coming up.
Yes, and which is cool.
And I have to pitch this event.
Otherwise,
Jeffrey Earls, our director of development, will
help. Hey, Jeffrey Earl, if you're listening.
Yeah, he was here.
I know, I had him on last year.
Yeah. He's a great man. And he's working hard at this. So we have a rock and roll concert, which is not your standard Fairfield County Fair. You know, we're not doing one of those uptight dinners at the Greenwich Hyatt. We're doing a rock and roll concert at the warehouse, at Fairfield Theater Company Warehouse. And the band we have playing, the headline band, is called Blue Coop, and it's members of Blue Oyster Cult and the Alice Cooper Band.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they rock. So if you know,
so y'all are really going to do some rock.
Yeah.
So like, this is real rock.
More cowbell, you know, that's what. So if you remember the Alice Cooper song, School's Out, or Billion Dollar Babies or whatever, or Blue Oyster Cult songs like Don't Fear the Reaper,
uh-huh.
This is the real guys. So we're excited about that. And
when is that? When is that?
That's April 13th.
Okay.
Doors open Thursday night, April 13th, doors open at 6:30. And warming up for them, this is a real treat, is going to be the School of Rock from Fairfield. So the kids are going to be up there for, you know, however long they're up there for, whatever set they're going to play. And then I understand that there's going to be a special encore, but gathering the Blue Coop guys, the Alice Cooper guys, and the Blue Oyster Cult guys, and the School of Rock, and they're going to do something all together for the encore.
Wow, this is going to be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. But I'm not, you know, I can't let the cat out of the bag as to what they're going to be doing for the encore. But anyone who knows Alice Cooper songs well enough, you probably can already guess.
There you go.
What they're going to be doing.
Oh, this is going to be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, I hope you'll come.
I may try to make that.
Yeah, for sure.
Get some good rock and roll in my bones.
Yeah, the tickets are available online on the Fairfield Theater Company website, or you can go to our website, familyreentry.org,
mm-hmm.
and click through. And
get your tickets.
Oh, the tickets are starting to go.
And the weather is so good now that it'll probably be exceptional by then.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it could be a rowdy crowd, you know.
We like that.
Mosh pit, whatever you're going
to
do.
You know, that might be my fantasy, to just like be walked over, you know. A little bit of a fantasy anyway.
Yeah, like Iggy Pop jumping off the off the stage and nobody catching him.
I need to be caught, though. Jeff Grant, it's so nice to see you.
Thank you, Babs. I'm really, really happy. Oh, just let me give you my contact information. It's Jeff Grant at familyreentry.org.
Yes.
And anybody out there, whatever your criminal justice issue is, whether or not you want a mentor, or you don't donate money, whether you have a criminal justice issue yourself, please get in touch with me. I want to hear from you. Jeff Grant at familyreentry.org. And that's our website as well.
Yes.
And, you know, this is our calling in life. So, yeah. You know, whatever the problems are, whatever the issues are, you know, just get in touch.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I know you'll be back. I'm not even, listen, this is my friend Jeff Grant, Executive Director of Family Reentry. He'll be back. So, Harry, thank you. You got my music? Happy Friday, y'all. When Tuesday gets here, I'm already hoping for the hump day. Wednesday night,
with this fool in a little while. Me and my girls, we turned it up last week. Boys love this club, cause ladies get in free. We love to party.
Dance all night.
Sexy on and